You've got questions, we've got answers.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Attorney General John Ashcroft has gone from anti-terror warrior to campaigning road warrior lately in his coast-to-coast pro-patriot act tour. Ashcroft is lashing out at critics who say the government is asking for too much legal power to fight the war on terror. So is the Department of Justice overreaching, or are critics overreacting? Tonight on Point, your civil liberties, the war on terror, and Patriot Act 2. But first, in a brig in South Carolina tonight, U.S. Army chaplain and Muslim Captain James Yee spends his 12th day in detention. The West Point graduate is a Gulf War I veteran and now one of about a dozen Muslim chaplains in the U.S. military. Last November, he was assigned to the detention facility in Guantanamo Bay. Yee was arrested on September 10th for allegedly possessing diagrams of the cells and facilities at Guantanamo. Bob Drogan is National Security Affairs correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him whether any charges have been filed against James Yee.
Captain Yee has not been charged either by the military or by the FBI. He was arrested on September 10th after boarding a plane from Guantanamo Bay to Puerto Rico, landing in Jacksonville, Florida. The FBI and the Army investigators interrogated him for several hours, confiscated some documents from him, and decided to arrest him. A military magistrate 5 days later decided there was sufficient grounds to keep him detained, and that's sort of where it is.
How long had this Muslim chaplain been visiting the prisoners in Guantanamo?
He was posted there last November, and since then he had apparently a very visible impact in terms of getting the right food for them, allowing for fasting during the month of Ramadan, which was in November. He brought CDs of the Muslim call to prayer, both from Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia, and he played them five times a day on the camp loudspeakers, and apparently was very visible and had full access to any of the prisoners or detainees whom he wanted.
So what is known about the military's concerns at this point about Captain Yee?
The investigation has variously been described as espionage, as spying, but we believe, and we're being told that it's into allegations of aiding the enemy, and in this case, that's the people there, either from Al-Qaeda or from the Taliban or from other affiliated organizations.
Muslim groups in the United States have raised the possibility that this Islamic chaplain was simply raising concerns about the conditions under which people are being held in Guantanamo, that he may have been sketching out who was where and how young they were and the size of the holding cell and so on. Is that a possibility?
Anything's a possibility. They're in fact quite stronger than that. They're saying he may well have been documenting abuses down there. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, various other organizations have been very vocal since Guantanamo Bay was opened in the fall of 2001. About what they consider improper treatment down there, and moreover, the rather murky legal status that the people there have. As you know, they're considered illegal combatants and have not been given prisoner of war status, so they're not allowed to see lawyers, they haven't been charged, and there have been a number of suicide attempts from people who just sort of feel that they've been thrown down there and forgotten.
The whole thing is such an incredible story, Bob Drogan. What can you tell us about James Yee's background?
Well, he's a fascinating guy because the military has actually held him up as sort of a model of modern military religious tolerance. He's a West Point graduate from 1990, Chinese-American, raised in a small suburban town in New Jersey in a Lutheran family, served in the Gulf War as Patriot battery operator, and at some point after that left the military and moved to Syria and studied Islam and studied Arabic and apparently married a Syrian woman. And then in the late 90s came back to the United States and rejoined the military and became one of really a handful of Muslim chaplains in the entire U.S. military. There are something in the order of 3,100 Jewish and Protestant and Catholic chaplains in the U.S. military and only something about 15 or 17 Muslim chaplains. And he's one of the few. And frankly, he became quite well known after September 11 because the U.S. government announced him. They put press releases out through U.S. embassies and the Voice of America.
As if to say, we are open to Muslims. Look here. Here's a success story within our military's ranks.
Right. As you recall, there were a number of people who were charging that the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq was part of an anti-Muslim campaign by the U.S. government. And there was an attempt, obviously, to show that the U.S. policy was not oriented in that direction. So he was brought out, and he gave a number of interviews to reporters even after he went down to Guantanamo Bay. But something presumably happened after he got there in terms of his communications with the prisoners or in terms of the documents that he brought out, certainly enough that he now is the focus of a very high-level military inquiry.
Is it possible that he might just have been known to be so concerned about the circumstances of their imprisonment there that he became a public relations threat to the U.S. military, that they needed to get him off the street because they didn't want him talking about it? Or are they really suggesting this is a spy who was attempting to help al-Qaeda, I don't know, make a prison break in Guantanamo?
There are other possibilities, too. It might have been issues about counseling prisoners as to what to say or what not to say or whether to resist or not to resist. I shouldn't speculate because we really don't know. All we do know is that it's serious enough that the U.S. military and a military magistrate felt compelled to detain this man. And you don't do that with such a high-profile figure, obviously, unless you have they have serious concerns.
James Yee's career path was unusual enough to draw attention in any circumstances, to go from West Point to a Patriot battery in the Gulf War and then to leaving the military, Syria, a Syrian wife, taking on the Muslim name of Yusuf and coming back into the military. Very unusual. How has that been explained?
He was being held up as a model, if you will, for the American military and for the idea of interfaith tolerance and pluralism within the American society. So his life story, which was promoted in the Voice of America and literally in a press release issued by the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo, of all places, was given prominence as this idea of sort of an American story that shows that U.S. policy is not against Muslims, that here's a man who was raised in one faith and converted to another and has been welcomed back into the U.S. military. So he was, I think, lauded as a model that people could look up to. So obviously this is a concern to people who were following him, who were close to him.
How public will the investigation of his case be? Will we be able to follow the progress of that investigation?
Well, that's also an open question at this point. As you know, he's being held in a brig, a Navy brig in Charleston, South Carolina, along with Jose Padilla and two other terrorism suspects who have not been allowed to see lawyers. Their trials have not been open. Their cases have not been presented to the public. And since he hasn't been charged yet, we don't know if he is indeed charged. And if it's a normal court-martial, then that would be open. But, of course, the military can slam down much harder in terms of closing trials and in terms of closing the evidence from the public eye.
Bob Drogan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Bob Drogan is National Security Affairs Correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Washington. Attorney General John Ashcroft has been all over lately on a 16-city tour from Seattle to Sarasota. Earlier this month, the Bush administration announced its support for a three-point plan to expand the USA Patriot Act. Dubbed Patriot Act 2, the raft of expanded government powers has raised alarm bells of civil libertarians on both the right and the left. John Ashcroft, in his whistle-stop tour of America, has been pushing back. Here's how he responded to critics of the Patriot Act last Friday in Minneapolis.
The lives and liberties of Americans are protected by the Patriot Act. The investigative tools we have used successfully to drive down crime and prevent terrorism are designed and intended to protect American citizens exercising their constitutional rights and liberties.
The Bush administration has argued that it needs extended legal powers to fight the war on terror in America and abroad. But at what point does the long arm of the law reach too far into the lives of Americans and those who live in America and around the world, into your life? Does the government need more legal power, or are the Patriot Act, Patriot II, and precedent since 9/11 taking a dangerous bite out of American civil rights? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University and author of the new book, Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. Good evening and welcome, David Cole.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
David Cole, take us right in, if you will. You have been watching everything going on in the realm of civil liberties since 9/11 and well before, for that matter. Your new book focuses in particular on how non-American citizens have been treated in this war on terror. But give us your overall response first to the kind of message that John Ashcroft has been delivering all across the country. You heard the clip just there. He says, this is not an erosion of American liberties. This is the defense of American liberties that we're trying to mount here.
Well, I think that the administration is acting with good intentions. They're trying to protect us. But I think that they have not made the case that the Patriot Act actually has made us more safe. They have not convincingly shown that a single prosecution that has been brought after September 11th could not have been brought before the Patriot Act was in place. It seems to me that we have made a fair amount of progress in the war on al-Qaeda, but it's not through domestic law enforcement. It's rather been through the war in Afghanistan, where we destroyed the training camps. We captured a lot of al-Qaeda people, including some very high-level people. We broke up their sort of center of organizational action. And the Patriot Act simply, you know, they have not made the case that it has actually made us safer. And what we have seen since 9/11 is a string of really extreme actions by the government in the name of preventing terrorism that we now know did not prevent terrorism. So, for example...
Well, just on that point, John Ashcroft says there is no fact or example to support the claims of erosion of civil liberties. You're saying that there are?
Well, I'll give you one. You know, after September 11th, John Ashcroft announced that he was going to undertake a preventive detention campaign. He compared himself favorably to Robert Kennedy and said, just as Bobby Kennedy would arrest any mobster for spitting on the sidewalk, I'm going to arrest any suspected terrorist on whatever charge I can find, whether it be immigration or what have you. Well, they have at this point, 2 years later, locked up 5,000 foreign nationals in anti-terrorism measures.
At one time or another, not today, you're saying. But at one time or another.
They're not locked up now, but cumulatively over this period, 5,000 people subject to preventive detention on the ground that, well, they might be suspected terrorists. Of those 5,000, four, and only four, charged with any crime related to terrorism. Of those four, two were acquitted. One pled guilty to trying to bring down the Brooklyn Bridge with an acetylene torch, and the other was convicted. Yeah, and the other was convicted of allegedly conspiring to provide material support to some unspecified terrorist activity in the future. I mean, they just had, and the vast majority of the 5,000 were not only not charged with anything related to terrorism, but were affirmatively cleared by the FBI of any connection to terrorism. So locking up 5,000 people who have nothing to do with terrorism does not make us safer. And when we see our government doing that in the name of preventive law enforcement, serious questions are raised about what are they doing to us, and particularly what are they doing to us with surveillance powers that are by their nature secret and set forth in the Patriot Act.
Jack Beatty, America's gone to war before and has taken liberties with civil liberties before to achieve a sense of security. Do you see this time as way out of line with the pattern of American history?
Well, 2 points about that. If we compare like to like thus far in this episode, we're not doing so bad. I mean, at this point in the Civil War, Lincoln had suspended the right of habeas corpus. He had closed down newspapers that were critical, really, of his administration. He had criminalized some of the criticisms the Democratic Party was making of him. In World War I, the Sedition Act was passed just within days of declaration of war, and it forbade, if I may read it, it forbade disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the American form of government, the Constitution, or the flag. And under it, socialists, pacifists, Eugene Debs were sentenced to jail for 20 years for speaking against the draft. And, of course, we know with the Cold War, with the McCarran Act and so on. And I'll come back to my second point when we come back.
We'll come and get it. Jack, stand by. David Cole, author of Enemy Alien, stand by. We're talking tonight about the war on terror, American civil liberties, and John Ashcroft's push for new powers. Who is overwrought here? John Ashcroft or his critics. The Attorney General is beating the drum for more leeway in the war on terror. Does the government need a bigger stick? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the war on terror, American civil liberties, and John Ashcroft's push for new powers. You can join the conversation. Are Democratic candidates' charges of a new McCarthyism under Ashcroft fair? Is defending non-citizen rights somehow key to defending all civil rights? And does the furor over a threat to civil rights feel overblown or right on target to you? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour, David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University and author of the new book, Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. David Cole, you write that there's an inescapable realpolitik to this. You say Attorney General Ashcroft and President Bush know full well that they will take a bigger, far bigger hit politically if there's another terrorist attack than if they lock up innocent Arabs or intrude on foreign nationals' rights. That's an awfully powerful political dynamic, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's why I think most of the government's response to the war on terrorism thus far has been of the form, we are not going to ask Americans to sacrifice their liberties, to choose which of their liberties they're willing to give up in the name of security. It may be that there are some that it would make sense to give up, but for the most part, the government has not asked us to make that difficult choice, but has instead said, we've got an easier way to strike the balance, and that is to take away the liberties of foreign nationals, and especially Arab and Muslim foreign nationals, in the name of your security. And that's easy for a politician because, of course, foreign nationals don't vote. Foreign nationals are already sort of the other in an us-them dichotomy that always arises in this situation. But the argument of my book is that if you look at our history, this has been the initial response in every national security crisis. But government officials, once they gain these powers over foreign nationals, learn to like them, and they seek to extend them to U.S. citizens. So what is done to foreign nationals today in the name of our security will be a precursor for what will be done to us tomorrow. So if we don't like it, if we wouldn't accept it for ourselves, we ought not accept it for foreign nationals either.
So when we see the prisoners in Guantanamo on the cover of your book in the famous photograph with them, the orange jumpsuits, handcuffed, eyes covered, ears covered, mouth covered, head covered, you're saying don't see those people as the other. One day they could be you. Jack Beatty, you've made sort of the broad analysis that so far civil liberties suffered more in earlier American wars than in this one. You had a second point there, and maybe it goes to this foreign nationals piece.
Well, in a way it does, and I don't take anything away from what Professor Cole has said. I think some of these things were ridiculous, and they are certainly worth worrying about. But, it has been the American way that once the war is over, liberties return. And Lincoln spoke to that very point, and I think he did it in a homely metaphor. He said that he could no more believe that the necessary curtailment of civil liberties in wartime would establish precedents fatal to liberty in peacetime, quote, than I am able to believe that a man could contract so strong an appetite for emetics during temporary illness as to persist in feeding upon them through the remainder of his healthful life. Well, that has been the way that after war times, after emergencies, there has not been a slippery slope, at least from war to peace. And even in the Cold War, which this episode may well be compared to in its duration, even there, the things like HUAC and other sort of vestiges of the Cold War began to become ridiculous by the 1960s, when we still had a Cold War going on and were almost laughed out of existence. So I don't mean to seem complacent, but I am saying that when you consider what was done here on September 11th, and when you consider what has happened in the past in American wars and emergencies, we're not doing so bad so far.
David Cole, I'll get your response to that, but I want to bring in a couple more guests first, if you'll be kind enough to permit me. First, joining us from Chicago, John Yoo. He's former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel at John Ashcroft's Department of Justice. He's now a visiting professor of law at the University of Chicago. Welcome and good evening, John Yoo.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And you just left the Department of Justice a couple of weeks ago, is that right?
In June.
In June, very recently then. And also joining us tonight from Washington, former Republican Majority Leader in the U.S. House of Representatives, retired from Congress last year after 18 years representing the 26th District in Texas, Dick Armey. Good evening and welcome, Dick Armey.
Well, good evening. And let me just say, in my own defense, I'm in Texas.
Oh, forgive me. You're well out of Washington at this point. Dick Armey, we've been hearing from David Cole, who writes at great length on his critique of precedent and Patriot Act since 9/11. He also writes for The Nation, famously liberal, and he's been right there battling on this. You've come at it from a different angle, conservative, libertarian, but also been a very harsh critic of these measures. Of what and why?
Well, I have to tell you, I am. I remember when, at least in my party, we sort of marched to the drumbeat of a wonderful quote, the extremism in the defense of liberty is a virtue. Mm. And I have to tell you, as soon as the dust settled on 9/11, we had the Justice Department up on the Hill making the case for all the new extensions of powers and authorities they should have. Most of which, at least much of which, the part that I was most interested and well informed on, had been authorities they'd been seeking for some time prior to that event and were not able to get. And I had the sense they were trying to stampede us. I don't think these people, anybody, when they get new authorities and powers, give them up willingly. That's why we put in as much sunset clause as
yes.
we could get in.
Mm-hmm.
They don't subject themselves to congressional review very well, and the only way you can make them to respond is to have them be concerned for the very life of the authorities that you've given them. So we worked very hard on that, and I want two more points. One, it is a honorable and unique American tradition that we afford the same liberties to persons within our borders as we do our own citizens.
Mm-hmm.
That should never be compromised, and we should defend it at that point.
This is to non-citizens, to resident aliens.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you are a person within our borders, read the Constitution. By the way, the people who wrote the Constitution were quite literate men, who
I'd
knew
say.
Very clearly what the meaning of the word is, was, and mm-hmm. they used it quite carefully.
Mm-hmm.
So the language they used was used with great deal of debate and quite purposefully. It is persons within our borders that are guaranteed these rights, and we have been a fairly honorable nation in fulfilling that promise. We shouldn't break it down now.
Let me just ask you on that point, Dick Armey. The cover of David Cole's book is a photograph of the terror suspects in Guantanamo. Would you hold them outside that kind of sacred circle of civil liberties because they were apprehended by and large, perhaps entirely abroad? Are you saying they don't fall under the constitutional protections, but anyone arrested inside U.S. borders does?
Well, I'd have to check those legal status, but from my point of view, I would interpret this to mean the United States and representatives of the government of the United States do not differentiate in the granting and honoring of liberty between those who are or are not our citizens. So I don't know the exact legal status of in terms of territories or whatever, but my own view is it should be a matter of our honor as a nation that our government, wherever it exercises authority, it does so in full protection of human liberty as we define it for ourselves.
Dick Armey, stand by if you would. David Cole, John Yoo, you're most recently in the Department of Justice among us tonight. Dick Armey has described John Ashcroft's Department of Justice as the most dangerous agency of government. You're hearing the arguments here this evening that civil liberties are endangered and that the failure to extend constitutional rights to non-citizen prisoners is also a threat to citizen rights. How do you respond?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish amongst three sets of issues. First is the Patriot Act. I think, as Mr. Armey said, and I have the greatest respect for him, it's a case that the Patriot Act, as he said, is mostly an accumulation of moderate evolutionary adjustments to existing laws used by law enforcement and the intelligence community to make them more administratively convenient, to improve communications.
Now, I'm really not sure I heard Dick Armey say that, modest evolutionary steps for administrative convenience.
Well, he said that, you know, these are things that the Justice Department has been seeking for a long time.
That I heard.
At the end of September 11th.
Well, let me just
There's
say,
no
that's
great
the
revolution
Justice Department's
in
characterization of what they are. That's not mine.
Forgive me. There's no great revolution in the Patriot Act in terms of the way that the government relates to its citizens or relates to suspects in the war on terrorism. A lot of them, the two major changes were, one, to modernize the use of intelligence surveillance laws to take into account new technology. The second one was to improve communication between the intelligence agencies and law enforcement because terrorists exist in both worlds. I think the second set of issues to keep in mind are the people of Guantanamo Bay. The people of Guantanamo Bay are enemy prisoners, and they're being treated as enemy prisoners have historically been. Enemy prisoners are not criminals. They're not defendants. They don't have a right to a criminal trial. They're detained as prisoners until the end of the conflict, and when that conflict is over, they're released. But they don't have any kind of right to go to court. They don't have a right to some kind of criminal trial or process. And this is something the Supreme Court has long held. They most recently held it at the end of World War II, that enemy aliens captured outside the United States are not entitled to any kind of judicial process. They're left in the hands of the executive as part of the executive's warfighting ability.
John, let me ask you, in your time at John Ashcroft's Department of Justice, did you ever find yourself sitting around with your colleagues there saying, my God, what are we tinkering with here? Is it possible that in the pursuit of administrative ease, or describe it as you like, that we may in fact be letting loose something that's going to be a real problem for civil liberties down the road? Was that ever part of the conversation?
I can say that, you know, when I served at the department, people were very conscious of civil liberties and constitutional rights at all times. I mean, you have to keep in mind the Justice Department, the great majority of personnel who work on these issues are career people who serve under administrations of all parties, and they keep a watch just as the political appointees do on constitutional rights and civil liberties. A lot of the proposals that form the Patriot Act, for example, were developed by those career officials. They were not formed by John Ashcroft sitting by himself at a desk.
How does it make you feel when so many prominent civil libertarians are just up in arms and right across the spectrum, as we see tonight, liberal, conservative? Does it raise any self-doubt, or you just think critics are out of touch?
No, I mean, this is what makes America great, is that every time the government does something, you have a full-throated debate, and I think I would be worried if there were no such debate about what the government does vis-a-vis the war on terrorism, because the war on terrorism is a new thing. It is a new threat by a non-state actor that hides among the civilian population, and the government is responding by doing some things it's never really had to think about since the Civil War. So I would be worried if there were no debate. I just happen to think that they're wrong, or at least that they don't fully understand perhaps all the considerations that lead into the Patriot Act or the way that people at Guantanamo Bay are treated.
David Cole, let me put it to you. John, you, fresh out of the Department of Justice, says that there's no great revolution in the Patriot Act, so settle down, everybody. It's just administrative.
Yeah, these are moderate evolutionary steps, I think was his term.
Yes.
Well, I don't consider it a moderate evolutionary step to give the government the power to keep out foreign nationals solely on the basis of their speech, something the Patriot Act does. I don't consider it a moderate evolutionary step to give the Attorney General the power to lock up foreign nationals simply by filing a slip of paper called a certificate without showing that the person is actually dangerous or actually a risk of flight. The only heretofore recognized justifications for preventive detention. I don't consider it a moderate evolutionary step to give the government the power to deport foreign nationals for innocent associations with groups that the Attorney General puts on a blacklist. I don't consider it a moderate evolutionary step for the government to change the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to permit the government in criminal investigations to do an end run around the Fourth Amendment and get search warrants and wiretaps without showing probable cause of criminal activity, something that we have always required in a criminal investigation. So I don't think these are moderate evolutionary steps. And with respect to the people on Guantanamo, John says that they're enemy prisoners. They are allegedly enemy prisoners, but they're not being treated like any other enemy prisoners before. Previously, when there's been any question as to the status of an individual, we have given them a hearing. And the Geneva Convention requires that we give them a hearing. It's not a full-fledged trial, but it's a hearing to make sure that this person is actually an enemy combatant, actually fighting for the enemy. We gave about 1,200 of them in the first Gulf War to Iraqis, and 800 of the people were determined not to be fighting for the enemy at all. Mm. We've refused to give those to the people on Guantanamo, notwithstanding admissions from military officers that many of the people there were picked up erroneously, picked up by bounty hunters, may well have very strong claims of innocence. And finally, on, you know, concern for constitutional rights within the administration, you know, it's great to hear that they were talking about it, but the only outside objective indication of any concern for individual rights and liberties was the administration's determination that it could not check gun records on suspected terrorists. It could lock them up, it could declare them enemy combatants and hold them incommunicado, but when it came to checking their gun records, that's where John Ashcroft drew the line.
Dick Harmey, you've been in this right up to your hips in the middle of Congress. You, like all of us, saw what happened on 9/11. John Ashcroft says repeatedly he's doing these things to make Americans safer, to safeguard American liberty. What exactly are you saying on that front, that these steps don't make the country safer, or that without them there's a greater risk, but it's worth it to defend constitutional liberties?
Well, first of all, I'm not qualified to judge the extent to which they make the country safer. I am qualified because I've been fighting this with a great deal of these new authorities to tell you that they wanted these authorities before we realized the threat that we realized on 9/11. But my bottom line is very simple. If you give up the liberties that we hold so precious that have set us aside and apart and distinguished us in the history of the world, for fear of your safety, then you, in fact, have given up what no other opponent or foe could ever have taken away from you.
And there it goes. John Yoo, these are heavy concerns, heavy fears. Do you feel the Justice Department has clean hands on this front?
You know, I don't see the great, you know, robbing of civil liberties throughout the country, the great suppression of First Amendment rights. I just don't see it happening in the country right now. I think there is a clear distinction that the courts have made in not reviewing the way enemy prisoners are treated, which I think is reasonable, as one the Supreme Court has upheld since the end of World War II. And the thing is, what's the cost? What has been the cost to society in exchange for the benefit of being better able to stop terrorists who, you know, look what happened on September 11th? I'm not saying that every single possible terrorist suspect could pull off such a thing like September 11th, but that's the benefit, is being able to stop terrorists who might pull off a future September 11th. And I just don't think that there's been a big cost to society so far in the reduction of any kind of civil liberties on the other side of the ledger.
We'll come back and look at that cost, but John Yoo, I know we have to let you go. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
John Yoo is a visiting professor of law at the University of Chicago and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel in John Ashcroft's Department of Justice. And Dick Harmey, joining us tonight from Texas. Thanks so much for being with us and for your perspective.
Thank you.
Dick Harmey, former Republican Majority Leader in the U.S. House of Representatives, we're talking tonight about the war on terror, American civil liberties, and John Ashcroft's push for new powers. We'll talk about them. Who's overwrought here, John Ashcroft or his critics? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is... I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the war on terror, about American civil liberties, and John Ashcroft's push for new powers. You can join the conversation. Does the furor over a threat to civil rights feel overblown or right on target to you? And does the acceptance of harsh treatment of non-citizens pave the way for similar treatment of Americans? In the wake of 9/11, will history accept or condemn the measures the United States has taken? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest for the full hour tonight is David Cole. He joins us from Washington, where he's professor of law at Georgetown University. He's author of the new book, Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. You're welcome to join us as well. And many of you would like to. Let's turn there. Anne's calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Good evening.
Good evening.
It strikes me just recently hearing what Mr. Ashcroft thinks about this Patriot Act making us all safer. If we were all in prison and all constantly under surveillance, we would all be safe, I suppose. All be terribly safe.
But, well, it's a thought, but let's not try it.
But I thought that we will only win the war against terrorism by being true to our true democratic principles, by being a free and just democracy. The world will stop shooting at us and copy us. We won't have to advertise. All we have to do is be a good, strong, honorable, honest democracy.
But Anna, are you saying then, does it follow that before 9/11/01, the country was not sufficiently that? I mean, because we were hit then.
We were too much pushing the world around with our biggest stick in the universe. And the United Nations ought to be the peacekeeping force of the world, and all the national forces can put themselves under the peacekeeping flag.
Is there any number of 9/11 style, Anne, is there any number of 9/11 style attacks that would make you say, I give up, we've got to surrender some liberties?
No. But as your guest so ably said, mm-hmm. we are taking away from ourselves what no enemy could take from us.
And we've got it. I want to turn to David Cole with that. And David, how do you see that argument? Do you look at the Constitution and American law and the options available to the Department of Justice today and say to yourself, there's plenty there. There are plenty of tools for them to use, even with this more extreme threat loose in the world, to keep Americans safe? Or are you saying Americans should just accept a margin of risk in order to safeguard civil liberties?
No, I don't think there's any absolute right answer about what the proper balance is between security and liberty. And I think there is a trade-off there. As Anne suggests, if the government could search all of our homes and tap all of our phones at will and lock us up without any showing that we were dangerous, it might well be able to capture more criminals before they act and after they act. But we wouldn't want to live in that society. So there is a balance to be struck. And I think in the wake of 9/11, there's a reasonable argument that we feel significantly more insecure, and we ought to think seriously about whether a diminution in liberty here would in fact create a promise of greater security. My contention, however, is that for the most part, the government has not asked us to make that choice, but has instead taken it out on the backs of foreign nationals. And that leads into Anne's second point, which I think is terribly important and goes to John Yu's point about the costs here. I think one of the real costs here is that when we respond in this kind of double standard way, when we respond by imposing on foreigners obligations we would never tolerate for ourselves, or when we respond by imposing on Arab and Muslim foreigners obligations that we wouldn't dare impose on the Brits or the French or the Germans, we play into Osama bin Laden's hands. We play into al-Qaeda's hands because we undermine the legitimacy of our cause and create recruits to their side and probably more significantly undermine our ability to work cooperatively with the very communities that we need to work with, the Arab and Muslim communities here and in the world at large.
You mean when they see the pictures of hooded prisoners in Guantanamo and around the world being treated in an extrajudicial way? Bad PR, bad image.
And it's just not a matter of, bad PR. Legitimacy is critical to any kind of effective law enforcement enterprise. When people view the government as taking shortcuts, as failing to treat them honorably, of not sharing the burdens equally, they are much less likely to work with government. And we're not going to find the al-Qaeda people by engaging in widespread ethnic profiling. We've done that, and we haven't found them here.
But are you saying,
we're much
David,
more likely to,
are you saying,
much
David,
more likely to
I'm sorry, I just want to clarify. Are you saying that the United States should extend due process to every terror suspect picked up anywhere in the world in whatever context?
Yeah, my view of the constitutional rights of foreign nationals is one shared by Congressman Armey, namely that the Constitution doesn't distinguish between citizens and foreign nationals except with respect to the right to vote and the right to run for federal elective office. The basic rights of fair process, of not being locked up arbitrarily, of speech, association, are extended to all persons. And when And they clearly apply to all persons within the United States. It's a little bit more complicated outside the United States, but where the government is affirmatively imposing its will and obligations on human beings, it seems to me that those human beings have the right to object that the government's exercising that power in a way that's inconsistent with the constitutional limits that go with that power. So I think the people on Guantanamo should have a right to due process. Now, what due process means in the military context is different from what due process means in the civilian context, but it shouldn't be different whether you're a foreign national or a citizen.
Jack Beatty, jump in here. I wonder how you're hearing this. We come back to this issue of whether or not the country is willing to accept some level of greater risk of terror attack in order to prevent or preserve constitutional liberties. David Cole says, look, put constitutional liberties first because they work for you around the world. And yet, you know, as a practical matter, and David points in his book as well, that if there should be another attack on New York or some other major city of anything like that magnitude again, people will be screaming at the administration, why didn't you do more? Why weren't you tougher? So what's the responsibility here to the Constitution, to physical safety?
Well, it came as a surprise to me to discover that Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution says habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it. Rebellion or invasion. Well, the terrorists, you could say, were invaders, obviously, of our space, and other terrorists would also be. And I'm not making any brief for suspending anything. But when George Bush turned to John Ashcroft on September 12th and said, John, don't let this happen again, I put myself in his position and I say, well, what would I do? And I guess I turn now to Professor Cole. You're the Attorney General. He says to you, Professor Cole, don't let this happen again. What do you do?
David Cole?
Well, I think there's a lot that can be done and has been done that does not raise serious civil liberties concerns. I think, for example, that they have improved airport security markedly, and they've done it in a way that is relatively minimally intrusive on our rights and liberties. Why? Because it affects all of us. All of us have a stake there. I think they have increased coordination between the various agencies that are in charge of law enforcement and intelligence, and I think that's a good thing. It didn't require much legal change to do that. What it required was a change of bureaucratic culture, and I think they're working on that. I think that makes sense. But one of the most important things I would have done would have been to have used the tremendous sympathy that there was for America right after September 11th, to reach out and make positive relationships, enter into positive relationships with Arab and Muslim communities here in the United States, Arab and Muslim communities around the world, to try to ensure that we can get their help in trying to find the very few Al-Qaeda people who are out there. I don't think it's irrational to think that or a stereotype to think that Al-Qaeda people are likely to be Arab and Muslim foreign nationals. That's what our intelligence tells us. It's a fact. But we're not going to find them by engaging in broad-based ethnic profiling that only alienates the very communities we need to be working with. We need to be reaching out, not alienating. And I think, unfortunately, this administration, while it said very early on we're against ethnic profiling, you had President Bush, inviting an imam to come and speak
going to the
after
mosque.
September 11th, mm-hmm. going to the mosque, et cetera. But when you look at their actions, I think we have seen a more extensive a campaign of ethnic profiling in this country since 9/11 than we've ever seen before, with the exception of World War II, mm-hmm. when people were treated as suspicious by virtue of being Japanese or having Japanese ancestry. Today, if you are Arab or Muslim or from an Arab or Muslim country, you are treated as suspicious for that fact and that fact alone. And those measures, interrogating them, interviewing them, making them register, prioritizing their deportation, detaining them, have not identified terrorists.
And you're saying those ripple around the world?
And they absolutely ripple around the world.
Vladimir's calling. I want to get a call from Vladimir calling from Boston. Hi, Vladimir. You're on the air.
Yes, I am. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention, I grew up in Yugoslavia under communist government, and you know, I've seen the secret detentions and not trials and things like that, secret wiretappings and everything else. And once it starts, there's just no end to that. What I'm really concerned is that, you know, all the things that U.S. is really known for and why people really have so much respect for U.S. society are potentially going to go away, that you're opening the door to start something that may lead to unlimited detention of not only non-citizens but also citizens. And the logic starts with, well, let's get all of the ones that are guilty, then let's get all of the ones that are potentially guilty. Let's then get all of those that are thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter whether we have thousands and thousands of innocent people in jail as long as we got all the ones that are guilty ones. And it just, there's no end to this.
And pretty soon liberties go right out the window.
Exactly. And you know, there's always a rationale for that. And any kind of government that engages in that kind of activity always finds outstanding reasons why this needs to be done and convinces the vast majority that this is really for the good of the society. But where does it end?
Vladimir, we've got it. And a voice from Yugoslavia drives it home. Thanks for your call, Jack Beatty. There's the, you know, one time behind the Iron Curtain voice saying, be careful, America. And David Cole says the same thing. Where does this end?
Yes, and you have to think what happens in the event of another terrorist attack, and will the public want more, and will that more make charges like the one John Edwards makes? He tells people, we cannot allow people like John Ashcroft to take away our rights, our freedoms, and our liberties. Of course, there's not a single person in that audience whose rights, liberties, or freedom has been taken away. But I fear that if there is another attack, if this does become the new Cold War with episodes, the destruction of our freedoms could well be one of the consequences of this war.
And David Cole, now we're looking at what's been popularly dubbed Patriot 2. We've just got a couple of minutes here, but there are three main thrusts in this. I guess the ability of federal agents to demand private records without approval of a judge or federal prosecutor, expanded use of the death penalty in crimes like terrorist financing, and making it tougher for defendants in terrorist cases to be freed on bail before trial. John Ashcroft says, we need these things to be effective law enforcement. What do you say?
Well, it's hard to accept that. I mean, you know, the notion that the death penalty, that adding a death penalty to a crime that already has life imprisonment for someone, for where you're talking about suicide terrorists, you know, the idea that's going to deter anybody, I think, is laughable. The administrative subpoena proposal is the most chilling, I think, because what it essentially says is the government can take the grand jury out of the process. The grand jury is a group of citizens of our peers who are always looking over the shoulders of prosecutors. And when a prosecutor brings someone in to testify before a grand jury, he knows that he's got 23 citizens watching what he does. In the administrative subpoena context, the grand jury is taken out of it altogether. There is no check of citizens of our peers on prosecutorial zeal, and you're brought into a police station and interrogated behind closed doors. And they have a non-disclosure provision that says you can't tell anybody that you have been subpoenaed. So there's no public scrutiny.
Vladimir, if you're still listening, I'm afraid that may sound too familiar from your time. David Cole, the hour's flown. It's been great to have you with us. And thanks for your new book as well. Thank you for all your thinking.
Thank you.
David Cole is author of Enemy Aliens, Double Standards, and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. If you're in the Boston area, he'll be discussing his book at 6 p.m. Wednesday night at Harvard Law School. For more information, go to our website at onpointradio.org. Jack Beatty, I just want to read one quote that David Cole has here from Justice William Douglas, U.S. Supreme Court. As nightfall does not come at once, neither does oppression. In both instances, there is a twilight when everything remains seemingly unchanged. Gives me the willies, Jack.
Ooh, and of course the Cold War was called a vast twilight struggle, and some people say we're in a new vast twilight struggle.
Well, eyes open, everybody, and here we go. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.